All right, let's call tonight's meeting to order. We get a roll call, please.
Steele.
Here.
Bergen, absent. Smith.
Here.
Mintz.
Here.
Sherwood.
Here.
Cable.
Here.
McBride, absent.
Are there any changes or additions to tonight's agenda? Seeing none, the agenda will stand approved. Are there any changes or additions to the minutes from the 4th of April? Then the minutes will stand approved. We do have a time for public comment. Scott, are you here for public comment or for an agenda item?
Agenda item.
Okay. Anyone else? We're good?
Are the staff allowed to act as public comments?
All right, then we're on to our first agenda item, our first business item, discussion of draft stormwater and erosion control ordinance. Amelia.
Okay, so, thanks, Stephanie. We have our current stormwater and erosion control ordinance. It's a work program item to update that ordinance. So we've been working on it for a while now. Really, what got this item onto the work program were several developments last year, including grading work, borrow areas, that illustrated the need for grading permits and an ordinance that was a little bit stronger, had some better teeth. We also are currently working with Emmons and Oliver Olivier Resources. They're a consultant, and they have been retained to complete a countywide watershed assessment. Last year, they did a draft technical memo that assessed our current ordinance and went through some recommendations. They will have a final draft that we'll share with you all when that becomes available soon, hopefully in the next month or so. So you reviewed the draft amendment at the March 7th meeting. Prior to this meeting, we sent an email out to request comments from stakeholders, including designers and engineers and developers and environmental organizations, and received some comments that have really helped us formulate this next draft. After the March 7th meeting, we sent out a press release that was recommended by the Board of Supervisors, actually. So we spoke on KHOI local talk show about the ordinance and also sent a request for comments to the Ames Home Builders Association. Tonight, again, we're only asking for additional comments on this from the commission or public. We're not asking for action at this time because we have placed the latest draft on the website and sent it to the previous list of stakeholders to gain more comments. We'll bring it back to you for action at a later meeting once we have received these additional comments and addressed them in the ordinance. So I'm going to go through changes since you last saw the ordinance briefly. These are based on comments we received as well as the commission's review. So the first change has to do with the definitions. Previously, we were using the term disturbance. I think it was Marvin that actually asked for that to be defined. And so we have decided to go with the term development instead, which has a current definition on our ordinance. That definition includes any man-made change to improved or unimproved real estate, including but not limited to structures, grading, paving, et cetera. So we're using development instead of disturbance now.
It's already defined.
Yep, and so another comment was regarding cumulative development. So development that occurs in different stages, potentially as part of a common development plan for one site or sites that are adjacent to each other. We've added a definition and a threshold for cumulative development now. We've also redefined runoff to specify that it references surface runoff. That was based on the comment. And we've also added a few other definitions that I'll go through here in a second, but those include environmentally sensitive areas, highly erodible soils, low impact development, stabilization, and topsoil. Second change major change was to the thresholds that we were proposing for when a stormwater control plan or erosion and sediment control plan would be required. So originally, as you'll recall, we had proposed a 10,000 square foot disturbed threshold for erosion control. Yeah.
So I don't know where you're using this language other than this presentation, but you're using...
Disturbed still. Yes, and so this is the previous language. Yeah. Good catch, though. Yeah, and so that was the previous threshold, 10,000 square foot disturbed. Yep. And so we've removed that threshold for erosion control and now are proposing that an erosion control plan would be required when there's commercial development, development that requires a conditional use permit, or development that will result in the division of land for three or more development lots. Our current ordinance has perimeter erosion control requirements for all development, and so we're proposing to retain that, not eliminate it. For stormwater control, the threshold has been increased to 1 acre developed, or 1 acre cumulatively developed, or if an NPDES permit is otherwise required for some commercial and industrial developments. Previously, this was 10,000 square feet of impervious surfaces created. And again, we got several comments that this was too limiting, so we've increased it to 1 acre developed. We've also added two exceptions to the threshold for cumulative development, and those exceptions are for legally established development and for the maintenance of legally established development. And so, with the first legally established development, we were kind of considering development that's occurred and been permitted prior to the adoption of this ordinance, how to treat that. And so what we came up with was, when you have new development on a site, when that cumulatively hits the 1 acre threshold, then you will have to submit a plan. But we won't count development that has occurred prior to the adoption of the ordinance towards that. We also have an exception for maintenance that has legally occurred prior to the adoption of the ordinance. So if you're maintaining development that was done prior to the adoption of the ordinance and you're not changing the runoff coefficient, for instance, if you went from gravel to a different type of surface, the runoff coefficient maintained, and you're not changing the size, you'll also be accepted from submitting a stormwater control plan. We've also made several changes to the provisions for the protection of natural resources. The previous draft included a threshold for a stormwater and erosion control plan if 15% of natural resources areas were disturbed. Also, in the previous draft, there was a discretion reserve section that was suggested by the consultant, EOR, in their review of our proposed ordinance. We have struck both of those. There were concerns about using the natural resources layer because of, the validity of that GIS layer, other concerns. And so what we've come up with is a new definition for sensitive environmental areas. Those include floodplains, lakes and streams, highly pervious soils, native grasslands, woodlands, watercourses. Did I say wetlands already? Those types of features. And so if you're in with 1,000 feet distance of those areas, you shall submit an erosion control plan. We have also added a threshold regarding highly erodible soils, and so we reached out to the Natural Resources Conservation Service, and they sent us their list of highly erodible soils, and we've included those soils in a definition. So if you're disturbing a soil that's considered highly erodible, you'd submit an erosion control plan. So we feel like this is a little bit more concrete now, some of the changes we've made. Further change regarding natural resources, we've added a waiver process to the proposed buffer from natural resources. So we've proposed that 100-foot buffer from natural resources, which is now sensitive environmental areas, is maintained on site during construction. Now we've added a waiver process to that buffer in case they need to access that area. Regarding topsoil, we got a comment on topsoil that it just needed further clarification about what we were requiring. Previously, we stated that you should respread topsoil to its original depth. The comment specifically said that sometimes they encounter topsoil depths that are really deep, and it might not be feasible to respread to that depth, or really shallow as well. And so we looked at the Iowa Statewide Urban Design Standards and Specifications and the Iowa Stormwater Management Manual at their best management practices for topsoil and soil restoration, and found that 8 to 12 inches is generally considered a sufficient amount of topsoil. So we've proposed that topsoil shall be respread to the original depth up to 12 inches. We've also clarified that resources such as the Iowa Stormwater Management Manual or SUDIS should be referenced for soil restoration work. Those resources provide information on combining topsoil with compost, tilling the land before you apply it, that kind of thing. We also received a comment on a provision in the ordinance for liability and responsibility for the plans. Previously, we included language on placing liability on the developer or property owner. So we've really clarified the county's role in the review of the ordinance, as well as that the county is not liable for damages. So now the language basically states that in no instance shall the plan submittal and approval be construed as approval of the design or construction or concurrence, that all criteria have been satisfied, and Story County shall not be liable for any damages. So simply stating that the county is not liable for damages. We used to reference best management practices shall be used from the Iowa Stormwater Management Manual or Iowa SUDIS. We specified those two resources based on a comment. We now specify those two resources or other professionally accepted best management practices, just to open that up in case there's new techniques that could be used. We've also included that low-impact development practices may be used instead of more structural controls for stormwater management. And finally, we've added a provision for how you can amend your plan if you're on site and find that a certain best management practice may not work. We've established a process for amending the plan and clarified that all amendments shall still comply with the requirements of the chapter. The amended plans shall be submitted prior to their implementation on site. So those are the changes. Any questions on those or anything else specifically you'd like me to go through, comments?
No questions?
For this environmentally sensitive areas, you are not using a map. You were using a map there previously, so if someone come in with something, look up where they live and see them in this natural resources area.
Mm-hmm.
Now you might use that as a reference, but not...
Sure. And so, the natural resources areas maps that we have is from the C2C plan. That's actually another work program item to go through that and kind of shore up some of the boundaries, make sure that map is a little bit more accurate. And so with the environmentally sensitive areas as well, we tried to pick out, features that were especially susceptible to erosion or stormwater impacts. So surface waters or, for instance, highly pervious soils, features that may assist in groundwater recharge or water retention. So we've kind of tried to get a little bit more specific and concrete with that.
How will we check for those things?
Mm-hmm.
How will we,
yeah.
When someone comes in, how can
Sure. So,
how do we know?
Right. So a lot of these things are still mapped. For instance, you know, the soils map for Story County that's available on Beacon. That shows where wetlands are located. We, of course, have a floodplain map and a surface waters map available on Beacon. The soils map, again, is available on Beacon as well. And we have defined, you know, highly erodible soils. Other features such as woodlands, you know, we could add a definition definitely of woodlands or grasslands or other features if you felt like that would be beneficial.
I'm just curious how things are going to be identified.
Sure.
Well, I believe USGS has a layer or land cover that probably could be used to.
Mm-hmm.
Who knows?
Sure.
I don't see that either.
Yeah, we can definitely look at that and make sure that we define those and how they should be identified. That's a great comment. Thank you. Yeah. Jerry?
Does the county ordinance have anything pertaining to retention, stormwater retention?
So the current one or proposed?
Either.
So currently our ordinance states that, I can read it to you here. It states that best management practices should be used to maintain natural hydrology, essentially. So it doesn't specifically say anything. With the proposed ordinance, we have some numeric criteria that a development should meet to control for stormwater runoff. We're not specifically stating that you have to retain, but that's definitely a practice you could use to meet those criteria.
It'll be up to the engineer.
Yeah, it's up to the engineer.
Design. It'll be up to the engineer, the consultant engineer, to actually design the site.
Sure.
And determine if detention or retention will help meet the standards.
Mm-hmm.
In reference to using the NRCS's soil survey, What do you feel is the accuracy of that in general?
And sure.
Well, how well is that regarded generally as far as accuracy?
Yeah, so I spoke with Margaret about this. You know, it could be different when you get on site, of course. So I think we could definitely add something in there that says if soils are different when you get on site, we could add in a caveat.
For on-site review?
Yeah, on-site review or something. But it is, you know, what the NRCS uses when they're doing practices for
as far as we know, it's a expected resource.
Yeah.
You don't get much argument with it, right? I mean, everybody just accepts it.
It's the only resource.
Really. Yeah.
And then regarding the identifying and defining sensitive features.
Mm-hmm.
So bear with me, but just suppose I buy 10 acres and I build a house on it, and my house takes up less than an acre in my yard, but I plant the rest of prairie.
Mm-hmm.
And I've got a good established prairie for 15 years. And so that's infiltrating water. It's a great benefit to managing stormwater. But now if I go in and want to do some additional development on my site, add a building, split it, build another house there, and am I going to be subject to, you know, buffer requirements and that sort of thing because I'm now impacting this ecological benefit that I planted and cared for?
Mm-hmm. So I think you would be.
Right.
You know,
so if I back myself into a corner by doing the right thing for 50 years.
The thing with the proposed ordinance, though, is we're just stating that within 1,000 feet of this feature, you have to submit an erosion control plan. And there's a buffer required, but we've introduced the waiver process to the buffer as well. There's a separate portion of the ordinance that we're not amending that would deal with removal of natural vegetative cover. You know, if you remove up to 15% currently in our ordinance, then you'd have to do some sort of mitigation of that, but we're not changing that here. So you'd have to submit an erosion control plan.
But there's a waiver now.
But if I had left,
but there's a waiver too.
If I had left all the extra land in row crop production all those years, up to the whims of the farmer as to how he farmed that, I would not have any of the same impacts to deal with come
So would you suggest like a definition be added of naturally occurring?
I'm not suggesting anything. I'm looking for unintended consequences.
Sure.
If he planted it and he wants to take out whatever square foot or a half acre or an acre, mm-hmm. there's a process that he can go through to request.
There's a waiver process. Yeah.
Okay. So, playing devil's advocate, the fact that there's a process I have to go through.
Sure.
To use the land that I did the right thing on for 10 to 15 years.
Is it a natural resource that you created?
Yeah. And I guess,
whereas I could have just left it in land that was filled up every fall.
Sure. And I guess the other side of this is that, you know, we had prairie before you tilled it, too. So.
How far back do we go?
Right. But row crop is the ultimate hands-off.
Yeah.
It's the ultimate way to reserve land
sure.
or how you want to use it with this few
right.
strings attached in the future.
Mm-hmm. But once it's a natural resource, you know,
yeah.
should be preserving it.
I wonder if there's a way to put in there distinguish between the naturally occurring resource and man-made natural resource. Right? Mm-hmm. If I turn my 10 acres into a park and I'm next to wetlands, and you want to do something to 5 acres of that, right? You should be able to do something to 5 acres of that, so long as there's not an impact outside of your boundary, right? So if you're next to a naturally occurring resource like the wetlands or something, you should be able to do what you want on your land so long as you don't impact your perimeter, right?
I just don't want to disincentivize doing something good.
Yeah.
Yeah.
If I put it in CPE now and 10 years I want to take it out, then I'm going to have trouble. I'm going to have to go through all these processes to do what I want to do now, but I want to wait. I may as well.
Well, I know what I would do if faced with that. None of this applies to agricultural use. I'd till up the prairie and I'd come back next year and propose my development. And these are the sorts of things that you don't want, you know, that regulation gets in the way of, and it causes us to do all these goofy things that aren't the right thing to do, but
turn it into a garden
right.
for a year, right. and then next year come back and say, hey, I want to turn my garden into whatever we need. I want to build 3 outbuildings.
Yeah. Anyway,
it's a good point.
I'm not suggesting proposing anything. I'm just saying, just looking for unintended consequences.
Okay.
You should be able to do what you want to do on your own land.
Because we've also had people come and propose things, right? We've had people come and propose, we want to build this development here, but it's going to require us clearing, you know, half the site from trees.
Mm-hmm.
But if we show you pictures from the 30s, you can see that these trees weren't here.
Mm-hmm.
That they're, you know, nuisance trees that have grown in, and so we're really doing a favor by clearing them. But now the regulations say,
sure.
if you're going to remove trees greater than 4 inches, you know, whatever it is, then so again, how far back do we want to go, and do we want to differentiate between, you know, undisturbed naturally occurring things and things that we've done. You know, that people have done intentionally,
mm-hmm.
right?
Is that? Yeah, and I think the intent of the waiver for the buffer that we put in was that, you know, if you're doing maintenance of, like, junk trees versus, you know, native trees, you can apply for a waiver to the buffer of 100 feet and just say, hey, I'm not going to have an impact on, you know, these native species versus, you know, maybe invasive ones. And it goes through the interagency review team. And
cut them all down and just say they were ash trees.
But it,
there's a lot of nuisance trees. They need to be out.
Absolutely. But again, the 15% removal requirement is completely separate from this as well. So we're just having a construction buffer, really. That you can have a waiver to. So looking at, you know, removal, complete removal would be a separate ordinance amendment process.
This is just a discussion item tonight. Mm-hmm.
Yep.
Correct.
Yeah.
But I'd love to hear Scott's comments on
sure.
this. I assume that's what Scott is here for. And I'd love for us to come back to some more discussion before we move on.
That'd be
any
cool.
other immediate questions right now? Okay. Scott, what do you have? Please. And your name and address, please.
Scott Rowe, Fox and Green, 414 South 17th in Queens. There's a lot to discuss here. There's nuances and there's always regulation in how that gets enforced. So what it says to me says one thing to me and says another thing to somebody that's doing the regulation. Also means one thing to an engineer versus another thing to the planning department. I've run into that occasion numerous times already. I just want to reiterate one of the things I said is I thought the erosion control stuff should just be thrown out. Don't waste your time with it because anything that's 1 acre and above requires state permit anyway, and there's state requirements, state regulations, state specifications for that. You don't need that. It does seem reasonable that they ask that you have your permit, but I don't know why we can see what's already done. Why does one agency think they have to watch something? Doesn't seem to make sense. Jerry wants to comment on regulating or how we're doing erosion control. There's a plan to refer to. It doesn't have to be a story kind of thing. It can be a plan to make it solid. So that's we're running into lots of problems on sites. My developers, I think, actually do a pretty good have a pretty good handle on most of these things. We actually have usually somebody full-time hired to do erosion control during the entire project from start to finish. Because when we get into the home builders, that things go wonky where they're just doing the stuff that they want to do and they don't care. No matter how much I tell them, they don't care. The owners, if they don't care. When they spend $100,000 for a lot, I should be able to do what I want with a lot. I know you've got to do this. But I don't have much left. So if you want to have some regulations for home building and whatnot, you need to consider that. No, you can't. For the most part, 95% of my sites, I think, look pretty good, but the home builders do a pretty decent job. They all put perimeter controls in anymore. We even, in our language, require that as part of the sale. So, have to make that. There's state requirements, by the way, that are interfaced with those home builders yet, so there are requirements that they have to meet as part of the permit. When they buy a lot, they buy the permit as well for all intents and purposes as part of it. So I just don't think there's a need to duplicate things to really my point there. You might argue that things need to be better, but I don't see that there's whole. It's mostly people do the right thing. In general, don't want to do the right thing. So. In the stormwater thing, I think you need to face the facts that every piece almost of every property in this county has been disturbed with touch. Almost all the streams have been canalized, almost all the streams have been impacted. We farm practically everything, we farm very little. There's very little natural area left to be addressed. Most of the time, the effect of the rules, talk about unintended consequences, is I do not go in and I don't fix stuff because I have to stay away from it. This natural resources boundary frustrates me, you know, and it's just a needless requirement. It's based on trees, which I find, as you said, most of the trees, if you go back and look in the 1930s, did not exist, very infrequent trees, and most of the trees really are causing erosion. They're mostly invasive. They shade stuff underneath, and you get erosion. I was out in my yard last night, and I have a fairly flat yard, and I live in town, and I got a tree that shades my yard, and now, you know, it's washing the dirt away. But when we're going into these things, we're trying to fix them, we're trying to stabilize them. This 1,000 feet is just kind of a random thing, and it's currently in the ordinance phrased a little bit different. But in essence, you should only be 1,000 feet downstream. I don't know why you think you have to do something 1,000 foot upstream. That's one of the rules that I don't quite understand. For me, the 1,000 foot means something. When you look at runoff, it's generally in the first 300 feet, we just have sheet runoff. We don't have any concentration of flow. From 300 to 1,000 feet, these are SES criteria from a long time ago. 50s, but from 300 to 1,000 feet, we start to form rills and have small erosion channels. Once we get to 1,000 feet, we're generally in some sort of channel that we're working in. So to me, the easier thing to do, and it says this in the Iowa Stormwater Management, is to look downstream and kind of make a decision to go and deal with the situation downstream. I'm not certain how we're impacting the sensitive area unless we're talking about floodplain or we're talking about the channel itself. And if those are the cases, then again, all those are all altered. A lot of cases, I don't think we're making it worse. The other part on the stormwater that I have a lot of heartburn about is taking urban standards and trying to apply them to a rural thing. I think it's a mistake. My degree is in agricultural engineering. I'm a specialist in agricultural drainage. I've been doing development work and doing the other side of it. I'm an expert witness in drainage law all over the state. See almost all the problems that you could, in some of them, imagine between different neighbors. I'm big about trying to prevent problems between neighbors. That's not the point, but standards that you're looking at as far as the Iowa Stormwater Management Manual and those protection volumes is an entirely different concept of low impact development. Those are two different things, and they don't actually work together very well, by the way. Most agricultural drainage is surface and tile. And so you have a very low flow system in the tile, and then most everything else is handled via the surface. When you do a low impact development, you usually try to enhance that and stay with that and keep out of the waterways, keep out of the areas that you know that are sensitive. Right? The way that system works is you site the houses after you've identified all the things that you don't want to develop. That's a different concept than following the Iowa Stormwater Manual, where we build stuff in order to meet that. And almost all of that stuff is going to require underground infrastructure of some sort that we don't have. It's going to require extensive drainage systems. It's going to impact how we do the tiles. It's a more intrusive, frankly, than doing low-impact development. I do like a low-impact development. I've done low-impact. Obviously, Ames follows this criteria for the rest. I did a lot of those well before Ames required them, just for good reasons, and if you want to go see some of those developments, I can point them out to you, but what I'm saying is it's two different criteria, and I don't want to have to argue at some point that while you're using low-impact development, but you still have to meet these requirements, that they're not the same. They're not the same thing. Some things you kind of get naturally driven to by the 15% natural space requirement that's in the code for developments. You'll take those areas and try to, you'll almost always use your drainage areas as part of that. If you look at low impact development, that's a fairly low number, by the way. It also depends whether you're doing 1 acre lots or 5 acre lots. If you're doing 1 acre lots that have really small houses on them, it's one thing. If you're doing 5 acre lots and with a big house but nothing else happened, or you're doing a 5 acre with horses on them, those are different concepts and different ways you approach it, things you get done. So I think this thing needs a lot of work. I just don't quite understand how a watershed study got to this point. I mean, in the realm of things, the watershed that urbanized are going to be developed for residential and story kind of still relatively small as everything else. It just seems like, well, you know, we can make the developers do stuff, we can't make the farmers do. And we try to appreciate that, but we're spending a lot of time and effort here that I'm not certain you're going to get much bang for at the end of the day. So mostly going to just discourage people from doing the right thing. So I do believe that we can improve things when we do development. That's always my intent on things. That when we develop, we'll make it better than what we left it. We do have a lot of urban people that are out there that are developing for the standards and have some situations that are, frankly, of their own making that they think somehow or the other that you're making worse. And it's like, well, you know, that 25-foot gully that you have in your backyard was not a 25-foot gully. You developed it, it's there because of what you did. You shaded the ground, you kept the grass in your own, and now we got a gully. And what I'm doing upstream, I don't know why I'm trying to rectify your errors. So people don't think about that. You know, I get a lot of calls from friends saying, hey, why don't you look at this property? And I go out and look and say, hey, I would not buy that property, and here's why. I'm giving a list of reasons why things that were sins that were committed that nobody, you know, they still buy the property because they have an emotional attachment, they like the views, they like a lot of things. But I don't really see the problem in the new stuff, mostly in the old stuff, where we're actually, you know, exceeding the 1 acre standard. It's pretty hard to build less than 1 acre on developments anymore. And the houses that people want to accept the existing thing and all that stuff. But that's kind of just a broad overview. Doesn't sound like we're just taking comments tonight, but those are just kind of broad overview.
Scott, what does Story County need to do to get developers to do more low impact development or conservation subdivision design? What would incentivize it to a meaningful point? And what's the market for it? What are the consumers, how do they react to it?
I'm going to start with the consumer part first because I think that drives some of it. So I've done quite a few developments that have low impact features. I'm always amazed of the calls that I get is, you need to mow those weeds, for example. I'm like, no, that's perf. And sometimes it's really good looking for it. And they go, no, it's weeds. I'm like, no, it's perf. Seriously. I don't know why you're going to do it. But what's the problem with leaving it that way? They don't understand. They want to mow it. When we have homeowners associations and they take over, I never know what's going to happen on mow things. So to a certain extent, it gets driven by what I think developers know this, that their customers prefer everything to be mowed and maintained and managed. They don't like wild and natural systems. I'll give you an example of a project I did in and it goes to a little bit of your discussion earlier about what if you did the right thing with property, right? So these people bought an 80-acre parcel in Marshall County, and it was really hilly, and it had been farmed for a long time, and they seeded it all down to CRP, and it looked great, right? They had neighbors around them that had anywhere from 2 to 7 acre parcels. Every one of those parcels, they mowed every lick of it. Evidently, it's a requirement when you buy a big parcel that you get a big mower and you mow everything. And these people came in, and we were doing a low-impact development. We're going to do we only were doing 7 lots on this 80 acres. We're doing a pond as well. And these people complained that, we're ruining the wildlife. I'm like, you guys aren't doing anything for wildlife yourself. Though admittedly, when you're out in your back porch and your back lawn is mowed, 500 feet away from your house, you can see a field mouse run across the lawn, And they thought, well, you're going to ruin the wildlife. Well, if you have, 5 acres you can do yourselves, they just wouldn't do it. That project ended up, just going away because this person was trying to do the right thing. And what happened? When it came out of CRP, they started farming. What else are they going to do? And so they had really hilly ground that was really a good place for development, but they did the right thing. And at the end of the day, the neighbors raised cane and they turned around and farmed. So you do get a lot of that. So. Low impact development, I sell on every project that comes in the door. Because generally the costs are less, the stormwater management issues are less. It's an easy sell from my standpoint. I usually can convince them that it's the least cost, the most return. It's not a hard thing to come to terms with. I will say in Story County, it's a real challenge just because parcels are sold not based on whether it's good for low impact development because they're available. Sometimes you get parcels that are really great for low impact development or really have no features to even be concerned about. And so you either build features in or it's parcels that are just available. It's not because they're actually good for low impact development. So I think that's the other part. You always have to look at it. In some cases, we create those. But again, it's not always the most straightforward process.
Other questions?
Thanks, Scott.
Thanks, Scott.
Thank you, guys. Appreciate it.
Staff, we do have low impact development option, but it's an option in our ordinance.
It's a zoning.
Oh, overlay.
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 So we're.
You have to rezone to get the overlay.
Yeah. So we originally, as part of this ordinance, looked at updating that as well.
Uh-huh.
It was a lot to bite off at once.
Yeah.
So we're planning on taking a look at that after this.
How often has it been utilized?
Hasn't since I've been here.
Mm-mm.
And is the major hurdle, does it require a shared wastewater treatment system? Does it not allow an individual septic?
I don't know. No one's even ever asked about it.
Okay. Well, the reason I ask is because sometimes I think maybe we'd be better off investing our energy into promoting, incentivizing the use of that option,
mm-hmm,
and those practices as opposed to regulating standard practices and, in many cases, adapting an urban standard to a rural environment. Go ahead, Scott.
For that, the combined wastewater systems, I would love to do every time, all right? I mean, to me, it's just a simpler and better long-term thing because it's just one system manager for 20 homes. But the problem is, as soon as you do that, you have a 1,000-foot buffer requirement for sited systems from existing houses and properties, and there's a different definition for what we looked at. So it's almost impossible to do in this county. There's almost always a house within 1,000 feet of the property. And so if you go to my system, means that you're not doing those just because you can't get a 1,000-foot buffer.
Okay.
So that's what drives that. And that's why we haven't done it. I would gladly have used it. I would have gladly put combined systems in, but the state DNR requires us now to put up with. There's a procedure to go around that. There's a waiver procedure, but it's very difficult.
So that's the big obstacle. So,
yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Okay.
And isn't there very few of them? There's like one development, North Ames, that's a kind of a combined system.
Yeah,
that's
so the only
kind
one that I know of, and it's actually one of my one of Fox's clients, yeah, is Squaw Valley, has a combined system.
Mm-hmm.
The other thing is trying to keep up with regulations with that as well. I take that back. I do have one in Boone County, too. It's just over the Boone County line. It's a system. But the way that the guy accomplished it was he bought 160 acres, and we ran pipes all the way to one end so that it was 1,000 feet away from it. So it looks kind of, if I kind of put it in the general area, you drive by and go, why that looks so fun. A nice, you know, flat area, and then there's this bunch of trees and shrubs and other stuff.
Mm-hmm. I just have a few comments.
Yeah.
That maybe we could talk about. I think we're glad to look at, you know, various distances from different sensitive environmental features. That's what Dubuque County does. We ran that by conservation, and they had some concerns and questions, and that's why we went with just the flat 1,000 feet, because that was for, you know, your surface waters, floodplain, et cetera. But I think we could look at that again. With the erosion control, our erosion control plan would be required for development under 1 acre, so it wouldn't be that if you're doing one over 1 acre, you have to do a separate plan for the county and the DNR. It wouldn't duplicate the NPDES permit necessarily. You could just submit your NPDES permit if you were over 1 acre.
Would the county be in a position to call into question any of the content of that permit?
No, you know, if
we wouldn't be the regulatory.
Yeah, no. Okay. If we, for instance, you know, we're on an inspection, we have a copy of the stormwater protection plan that they submitted as part of their permit. Noticed that something was clearly missing. You know, that might be one situation where we reached out and said, "Hey," but otherwise, no. And we, you know, feel that currently, all development in Story County is required to use perimeter controls. Do we really see any of those being used? No. On a lot of these home sites, as Scott mentioned, with the home builders. And so we really thought we need some sort of leverage here as the county to say, hey, you're supposed to have these controls out, or you're supposed to have stabilized this within 14 days. You're supposed to have seeded this, and we really don't have any leverage currently. On stormwater, with the urban versus rural standards, you know, like Scott said, these standards are in the Iowa Stormwater Management Manual, the Unified Sizing Criteria Standards. Johnson County has adopted them, Dubuque County, a few others. You know, and of course we want these to work and be effective, so I welcome any comments on how to improve them. But the first standard, the site shall be designed to manage water quality volume of a rainfall depth of 1.25 inches by infiltration practices. You know, when we're talking about rural versus urban development there, just infiltrating water, I don't know if that standard, for instance, would need to be changed. If you're just doing infiltration and it's a larger area and you can do different best management practices on your lot to encourage that. The other two standards for protection of stream channels and protection of, for flooding, you know, you might need to be using some detention or retention basins there. But again, you know, with rural development, we thought other practices could be used as well that would just use the natural hydrology of the site. But I'd welcome any feedback on how to improve those standards, but it is what other counties are using and what's recommended. And
we're trying to strike a balance.
Yeah.
You know, we obtained a lot of information, too, from the Iowa Stormwater Education Partnership, which is also somewhat of a very knowledgeable resource. And so we've actually gotten information from them with regard to this current status. We've had multiple revisions that we need to do more than what we're communicating to them.
They said that we're cutting ourselves short here with this one. So we're going to talk to them again on Friday, but we're really trying to strike a balance to adopt something that's workable and will have an effect. So
I'm not as familiar with, you know, what provisions already exist at the state level and the county. But if there's already state requirements for lots of a given size and we're interested in revising ours because maybe ours aren't, you know, we're revising them because they're not what we want them to be, right? We want to encourage a different result. How much of this could we do by just eliminating ours that's not working and referencing what's already out there versus then creating something to encourage, you know, a specific result, right? Mm-hmm. So rather than doing a blanket proposal of we could eliminate what's out there that's not working or not up to date, adopt and just reference, you know, state code requirements, and then build ours to as an overlay to specifically encourage, you know, specific types of development or specific type of hydrology management, right? Or address sizes that, or situations where the state doesn't cover it, right?
Yeah, so again, the state has NPDES permits for construction sites over 1 acre and other industrial and commercial uses like mineral extraction. So that would be erosion control, but post-construction stormwater doesn't really have much.
Okay.
You know, with erosion control, again, we've just seen issues where we should have had the ability to require a grading permit or some sort of plan, and we've got nothing.
Right. All right.
So, yeah.
Mm-hmm. And again, we do reference the state permit for properties acre or greater, and then for less than that, we have language for practices that they can put in.
This could conceivably add
two additional plans to be submitted and resulting in two additional permits, each with their own application to a particular development.
Mm-hmm.
True?
Potentially.
Mm-hmm.
So you have to get, so we'd be going from a zoning permit required to zoning permit and a stormwater permit and an erosion control permit.
Well, and there might be, or if you're, in flood, you're impacting floods, there may be a floodplain.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Do they all have fees?
In two respects.
We don't have it. We have
floodplain, zoning.
Floodplain and zoning. But these are, so the erosion control plan and the stormwater control plan, those are required to be submitted. For erosion control, we have that grading permit aspect mm-hmm. in the case. Because in those cases, typically, you don't always need a zoning permit if you're just doing grading. Yeah. So we could definitely specify that a little bit more.
Just.
Mm-hmm.
It bears consideration that you're going from currently requiring one permit, maybe two if it happens to be in the floodplain, to mm-hmm. potentially three.
Sure.
Two of which come with a plan that has to be developed by a professional.
Mm-hmm. And our intent, we've updated the thresholds here for 1 acre developed or, conditional use permits, commercial sites, subdivisions over three lots. So it's not your residential partial subdivisions. It's not your one house on your 35 acres. We can definitely look at, again, the environmental sensitive areas, 1,000-foot threshold, to make sure that this isn't overburdening. Yeah.
I don't mean to hog the mic, but one thing that would help for me, mm-hmm. and you can decide if you want to put the energy into this or not, but one thing that would help for me when and if we're asked to actually make a recommendation on this is some scenarios that demonstrate how this would be applied.
Sure.
This home built on this size of a lot, got a wetland within 500 feet,
mm-hmm.
what would be required in terms of fees
mm-hmm.
and plans and professional services required and permits? What will that,
sure.
what impact will that have on the property owner?
Sure. I have one example right now.
We can get you more.
And we'll get you more,
okay.
for sure.
It just helps put it into play.
Yeah. I tried to recall past permits because I reviewed residential permits, and there was one house recently that may have been required to submit an erosion control plan. It was or a stormwater control plan. It was huge. It was set back about 400, 500 feet, so you have a big driveway that disturbed a lot of area, and then the house itself is 100 by 150 or so.
That would be the exception.
Yeah.
Okay.
But I'll get you some more examples for sure.
Yeah, that
sure.
would be a lot.
Yeah.
Hopefully it'll be helpful for us too.
Mm-hmm.
Other feedback for the staff? When might we expect this to take action on it?
Potentially next month.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. All right. Any other comments? Then we will move on to the draft impact analysis and study ordinance.
Okay, so I just wanted to start with a traffic impact analysis and study ordinance draft. Just discussing what the goal of the ordinance is. Again, this is another work program item, and the language is to develop guidelines for use and applicability of a transportation impact analysis in conjunction with the development review process. So this is very much about proposed development. This came from the C2C plan. The transportation goal number one, which is provide a safe, efficient, multimodal, and well-maintained transportation network for all residents, farmers, commercial, and emergency vehicles. There's an objective under there to manage access and design of the transportation network in order to effectively maintain the safe and functional integrity of the roads and bridges within the county. And then the strategy is where this work program item came in, and that strategy is to require that the property owner or their agent fund the preparation of a traffic impact analysis by an independent professional prior to approving new development in unincorporated Story County. So I will just briefly go over just the highlights of the ordinance. We have a definition section, the purpose of the ordinance, administrative requirements. We're then requiring all development proposals to submit a traffic impact analysis at conceptual review. This is a very abbreviated amount of information. It looks at the number of vehicle trips generated by the proposed development, the existing number of vehicle trips per day on the county and public streets within a quarter mile of the proposed development, and the analysis, some analysis to determine if the existing street conditions and intersections within a quarter mile of the proposed traffic are adequate and provide safe access to the proposed development. So every development application would be required to submit that. After that, if determined necessary by the county engineer or the Board of Supervisors, a traffic impact study would be required, and this would be based on the number of vehicle trips in the peak direction during the site's peak traffic hour. So if there are up to or fewer than 100 vehicle trips in the peak direction during the peak traffic hour, a limited traffic impact study would be required. And so there are, the contents are outlined in the ordinance. If it's more than 100 vehicle trips during that peak, in the peak direction, during the site's peak traffic hour, there's a more comprehensive traffic impact study that's being proposed as a requirement. In the event that the county engineer does not see that it's necessary for either the limited traffic impact study or the complete traffic impact study to be done, the Board of Supervisors does have the option, of course, based on input from the Planning and Zoning Commission, based on public input, to require a traffic study. All funding of infrastructure improvements would be a decision made by the Board of Supervisors, and that is the case anyway with all infrastructure improvements in the county. So from a couple months ago when we looked at this, the main changes to the draft ordinance included definitions of levels of service. We defined each level of service A through F in the definition. We added language addressing phased development projects, and that is, if phased development is proposed, the traffic analysis and our study shall include projections for the year that each phase of the development is planned to be complete. So we had discussed previously how to deal with kind of piecemeal development, and so we can that's how we looked at it. You can kind of tell when, like, for example, a subdivision could be expanded or not. They kind of leave dead-end streets that could be further expanded. So that was our attempt at that. We also added descriptions for site traffic distribution and site traffic assignment requirements of the complete traffic impact study, and then we tried to do some clarification of the roles of the county engineer and the Board of Supervisors relating to the ordinance and implementation of the infrastructure improvements. So our next steps, unlike the stormwater, we have not yet routed this. We felt like it wasn't in a good place to provide to developers and stakeholders and the interagency review team. So we will. That's our next step, is to really get input from you, incorporate it, and then provide it to the public for feedback. And then, of course, we'll bring it back to the Planning and Zoning Commission. We did spend some time talking with Darren, the Story County engineer, and we asked a bunch of questions, I guess. We just kind of picked his brain.
Had meetings with him and obtained information otherwise.
Yep, so we really hit him with quite a few questions and about what they currently do to look at traffic. So one of the examples he provided was that based on observation and engineering judgment, a turn lane was added onto Cameron School Road to turn south onto George Washington Carver to go southbound. So that was added. That was a low-cost improvement to the intersection.
They already had the right-of-way space for it.
Mm-hmm. The engineering department does monitor intersections, referring to the manual on uniform traffic control devices, which has standards for warrants 1 through 4. Or I'm sorry, 1 through 9. Sorry. engineering did also complete a traffic count and turning movement study or review at Grant Avenue and 190th Street.
Last fall during school hours, the numbers that were obtained during that time did not meet the warrant for a four-way
stop there. I believe they did try to put in stop signs temporarily there.
For a four-way.
For a four-way stop, again, at Grant and 190th. But people were blowing through them. So they were ultimately removed. Again, the count didn't warrant the four-way stop. The other thing with this intersection that's a little bit unique is that half of it is within the city of Ames. So the county would have to work with the city of Ames to figure out what improvements they feel are necessary. It was Darren's kind of projection that once the city extends the bike trail south, they would have more ideas of what needs to be improved at this intersection. So we pulled some annual average daily traffic numbers from 2007, 2011, and 2015, and I will let Jerry speak to those a little bit.
Great. You know, this ordinance will impact all development within the unincorporated areas of the county, but
we went through the review that we did for the Ames River Fringe Plan, the north area between Gilbert and Ames, and there was some discussion about current traffic levels, primarily on the north-south roads, George Washington Carver, Grant Avenue, and Highway 69. And so, as Emily said, this information is from the Iowa Department of Transportation. It's annual average daily traffic counts. And for the most part, they're doing these counts on a four-year basis. So we've got data is available for 2007, 2011, and 2015. So that means the next planned count would be 2019. So some of this information you know, maybe dated. There may be some growth that's not accounted for. But this is a snapshot in the north area for the most part. We also have some counts to show you, like on the south area of the city of Ames. But again, these are the three major corridors from Gilbert to city of Ames. George Washington Carver, Grant Avenue, and Highway 69. This is from 2007. You can see most of the traffic is generated in this area from Highway 69. Each square represents a square mile. The count information is highlighted in yellow, these areas here. And it could be north or south movements, vehicle movements. But as you get to 2000, 2015, again, Highway 69 is the most traveled, and then probably the second highest traveled road would be George Washington Carver. We throw out some percentages just to give you an idea. Grant Avenue, south of Gilbert to 180th Street, had the greatest increase of 47%. But then it drops off as you go to the south. Again, this is from 2007 to 2015. There was actually a decrease in traffic. So, you know, that can mean a lot of different things, but likely, you know, they could be using 180th Street to get out to, as a route
so,
to get out to,
Jerry,
to
I need
the
to,
freeway.
I need to leave my house in West Ames at 6 o'clock to catch a flight. So... And you know how interested I am in this stuff.
Yep.
So I need to make a couple of comments, and then I need to go. But I'm looking at these infographics, the north-south from that north side of Ames and the east-west.
Right.
And either I am really not understanding or there are some problems with the math. If you look at the north-south, right there south of Gilbert, it's an increase in traffic of 47%.
From 2007 to 2015.
Right. So just there's an increase of 47%. So from 2007 to 2015. If you look at then continuing south on Grant or Hyde or, you know, where, it now drops to – it decreases for –
correct.
Right? So the – that increased traffic of 47% is going someplace because there's really no development between there. If you look at the east-west, the places where that traffic would go is flat. So you have 47% increase in traffic that goes nowhere. There's no increase in the east or west routes out, and there's a decrease in the route south, but north, there's a 47% increase in traffic, which would indicate that there is traffic basically going from Gilbert to 180th, turning around and going back.
Well, there is an increase if you look at the east-west, 170th, 40% increase west of the city, and a 62% increase
okay,
east of the city.
That would mean the traffic's originating from someplace north of 180th, and getting and between 180th and 170th, right? There's a 47% increase in traffic there. And east-west, on the other contributory roads, there is a 0% change. I have a similar issue with looking at George Washington Carver. North-south, it's 27.5% up, 27.5% up, 16% down, and then 43% up. But the east-west, from between that 27%, 27.5%, and the 43%, where it drops 16%, the east-west is also dropping.
Right.
So where is that traffic coming from or going to, right?
Well,
I'm just...
I mean, yeah. These numbers came from the DOT count.
No,
And it's just the 0% is really on the east and the west side of Grant Avenue at that intersection of 180.
Right. So that means east-west, there's no apparent change between 2007 and 2015 in traffic, which I find hard to believe with the amount of development there and the increase in traffic on George Washington Carver. And
there's the numbers
there.
I'm wondering if we could compare these numbers and your findings here with the percent change difference with the MPO model and what they projected into the next 10 to 40 years to see if they these numbers kind of line up with that at all. So I think as being a jurisdiction in the MPO, kind of get those numbers and.
Yeah, I'm looking at the infographics, and I see that you're showing the numbers, and the numbers don't change. How do we get a 47% increase in this section? How do we get a 40% increase and a 27.5% increase in these sections with a drop or flat in these in-between sections with no additional traffic going anyplace else.
That's why I'm suggesting looking at the model, because it looks at more of the complexity of it. I think these are just raw numbers, so you might get some differences. You know what I mean?
I don't think they mean anything.
Really,
I don't know how we get. I honestly don't know how we get the differences where you see dramatic increase on George Washington Carver, dramatic increase on 69, zero increase on any cross traffic, which in the 13 years that I've lived here, I have seen. So I know it exists, and all the development that's happened where people are doing that. Right? We've seen how many developments go along Cameron School Road, and they're saying traffic on 190th is decreased.
15% is strange.
That minus 16%, I don't know. Yeah, so anyway.
Well, I wonder.
I would like to continue looking at it. I have to go.
There could be a margin of error on some of these. To look to the DOT to see if, like, there's some kind of margin of error. Well, basically, you're just taking the numbers and looking at the difference.
Exactly.
And
right.
I just think this is a kind of a complex situation and area. I think maybe the model could look at it differently with the complexity.
I agree with Warren. At face value, it doesn't make sense.
Are you going to have a comment?
We are on the ordinance, which this is all just complimentary information for the ordinance, so.
Can you answer that question?
Yeah, give it a shot. What do you got?
So, a lot of times they don't have enough counters, so the counters will be out, and they'll count one part, and they will not count another part. They'll move the counter and move to another part, and so they're counting different days.
Yeah.
And not only that, you can't only count on the counter. So you get a lot of garbage in and garbage out, and so you're trying to decipher something that, honestly,
so it's wrong for us to assume that they did this numerous times over the course of a week in the same place to get a good average.
Yeah, they're looking at it as kind of a model thing, which when you do models, you really don't worry about precision all that much. You're just trying to get kind of in general terms. It's more important to know whether it's 500 versus 3,000 versus 50 versus, you know, nobody cares about 50 versus 60 or 700 versus 800. It's kind of the oldest thing. But the counters get moved around, they don't work, you know, there's lots of reasons for it. And when we're doing analysis like that, what Marvin did, we see that all the time, and it's just like, you can't make, don't try to make sense of it. There is
nothing. Okay. Which might actually be the best case for a traffic analysis.
Well, that, and that's kind of the point.
Yeah, and that was the other thing. You know, that definition you're using is really abstract, even for me. Peak hour, 100 vehicles per day, peak hour, peak traffic hour, all right? So that means you have something that you're basing that on when you start, which most of that data isn't available. And so 100 vehicles per day, peak hour, is a pretty good size number even for a development. And none of the developments that I've done in the county would even get close to that 100 vehicles per day per peak hour. So
yeah, from 0 to 100.
Yeah, I understand, but I'm just saying it's more of a cumulative thing when you have lots of people do small stuff, and then everything's in Ames. Then here's the other thing is, I don't have the exact numbers, it's actually in my office, but the import into Ames each day for people going to work is just, it's huge. Like 12,000 or 18,000 people extra coming in versus what goes out. Because Ames draws everybody in. So every side road, every road that comes into Ames, has got traffic numbers that are eye-popping coming in every day. And part of that is Ames just does not make it easy to do development, so we're helps everybody. But it does mean putting an awful lot of pressure on all those command roads, no matter how they go.
Thank you.
And like Emily said, we did have a lot of discussions with our county engineer, and I mean, they are using this data for the work that they're doing, are planning to do. And the hope is that the ordinance that we're drafting, you know, that it would serve as a baseline to try to figure out, you know, where a starting point might be to figure out what would be added.
The county's gathering its own data to determine if it meets those warrants, though. Correct.
In specific locations, yes.
Specific locations.
Mm-hmm.
On
yes.
a micro level.
Jerry, you showed me some numbers the other day when I was over here for another meeting. Just so we were both in a hurry, and I was going to ask you for copies of those, but are those the numbers?
These are the numbers.
Okay, we just got the percentage change numbers here. We don't have the raw numbers.
Correct.
But you had some raw numbers that you were showing me that day.
And those are here. Is there a specific road you're looking for?
And part of what we're trying to show is there's probably just as much impact on the east-west roads as there might be on the north-south roads. Because at previous planning and zoning commissions, we've had that discussion about the traffic volumes. So we're trying to illustrate or do a comparison of the north-south to the east-west. We got here east-west.
These are the numbers upon which the percentage is based.
Correct. Correct.
Right. The counts from 2007 to 2015. And then, like, if you look at the south, South Dakota, University, Highway 69, you know, most of that traffic, again, is on Highway 69. Second heaviest traveled would be South Dakota. You look at the percentages, it's a 67% increase over that eight-year period on South Dakota. 73% decrease. But again, there's, you know, with the improvements that have been made with the research farm area, that's likely not the same. I mean, there's probably been a change to that. And then there's been a 20% decrease over that eight-year period on Highway 69. So that means they're using other routes.
On the ordinance, the draft ordinance, it's all good information. That's what we're actually needing to tackle for the moment.
Right.
I know you covered this, but just so I'm clear, Emily, it's basically a two-step process where they submit the traffic impact analysis with their application, mm-hmm. the original development application.
Correct.
And then only the engineer or the board of supervisors can call for a full study. Is that correct?
Correct.
Well, with input from the general public and the Planning and Zoning Commission.
Okay.
So what I'm wondering is,
would be another option.
So I don't think that we should be able to demand it necessarily, but we may never see a traffic study then. Because if the engineer doesn't call for it at interagency review before you ever bring us the application, then the board of supervisors sees it after we do, and they might hear our comments saying you need a traffic study.
A recommendation that it would be needed.
Right, but we would never get to evaluate it in light of the study. It would be beyond us.
You're going to get to see the peak traffic numbers from the what would be generated from the proposed development and its impact on the adjacent road system.
Right, but not a full traffic study.
Right.
Unless the engineer says from the very beginning, this would need a study.
Right.
Any questions or input to the staff? Okay.
And again, we intend to get this out to engineers, developers, the development community.
MPO.
All right, very good. Thank you, staff, for all that hard work. Appreciate it. Are there any staff comments?
Other than likely you may see these two ordinances for action in June, which is the June 6th meeting. It would take a majority of the seven-member body to take action to approve. We may have a conditional use permit for the Pleasant Grove Church. They're proposing to do a parking, off-site parking improvement, and then a building to be used primarily for their use for church members. We're working through some issues with that. Manats, maybe we may have a conditional use permit for a construction and demolition site for excess materials storage to be used for future projects, county road projects. And then I just need to let you know that the our department did receive a copy of a petition. It's the third petition for the McKay property for the conditional use permit that Mr. Perkins submitted for the commercial campground and RV park. So in each one of those will be dealt with separately in district court.
So the Board of Adjustment did approve that?
They did approve it, and challenged. It got challenged.
Did they make any modifications, or did they follow our recommendation?
It got approved.
Mm-hmm.
As recommended.
Right.
And then so the hearing on the first challenge, which involved the YSS conditional use permit, will be next week.
Any comments from the commission?
I'm just wondering where all this goes. You do an impact study and the developer takes action or submits a plan that whatever is within the developer's control, the developer satisfactorily your plan's okay. But you've got a road that the traffic has been increased and could be increased exponentially upon, and particularly cumulative effect, and I'm glad you got that in there, but the cumulative effect of subsequent developments that we all know about. So what happens then?
So part of the ordinance speaks to how the results of the traffic study could be as determined by the Board of Supervisors, what improvements would be the responsibility of the county, what would be the responsibility of the developer, and so it allows them to determine that based on the study.
So would a permit be denied? Would a plan be denied if the county didn't want to do anything to that road?
You're talking about the actual subdivision plan?
Yeah.
I think they could weigh all that information, what's being proposed, what the impact might be on the county road or adjacent roads, whether they be county or private.
It's part of our standards for approval, right, for a subdivision.
Right.
All right, any other commission comments? Do we have a motion to adjourn?
So moved.
Second?
Second.
We are adjourned.
Thank you.
Thanks, staff.